We're gonna jump in. It's gonna be a busy morning. We have Sunday school, and then this morning we're having communion with each other, and then also there's a baptismal service this morning. And so after the morning service, there's a newcomers fellowship. So it's gonna be a busy morning. If you have kids going to junior camp, there's a junior camp parent meeting at 5 o'clock, and then there's church at 6. So you might as well just brought a lunch and stayed here all day. It would have been fun, huh? So guess what I'm going to do. Anyhow, let's pray, and then we'll jump into Leviticus and see what we can accomplish here. Lord, thank you for just the privilege to be able to worship you. I'm thankful, very thankful that your decision was not to create the world, create everything, and then leave us to figure it out. But your plan was, and the way you did it was, you created everything, and then you revealed yourself to us, not only through creation, but through your word. And it wasn't your word that just revealed to us the impossibility of reaching you. Your word reveals to us exactly how you desire to be worshiped and how we are to respond correctly to you and your desire for our lives. And I pray that if we don't learn anything else from Leviticus, that's the lesson that we'll learn is that you desire worship from your people your way. And I pray that you would help us to submit ourselves, not to how we desire to worship, but submit ourselves to your desire for worship. I pray you'd help us to be encouraged and eagerly anticipate this morning our meeting together with each other and our time with you, Lord. I pray you'd help us to take seriously our responsibility this morning to stir one another up to love and good works, that we would not be here as spectators, but we'd be here participating in worship of you and in encouragement of each other. And I pray this would be a morning that really solidifies your place as preeminent and our responsibility as servants and stewards. Lord, thank you for bringing us together this morning. I ask this in your name. Amen. I guess you can't tell by my prayer. I'm kind of pumped. That's probably, we may be in big trouble. Good thing I'm not preaching on top of communion and baptism. That could be a while. We're in Leviticus chapter 26. We're working our way to the end. What we have now at the end of the chapter is the codified statement, if you will, that says, if you do this, here are the blessings. If you don't, here are the cursings. We got that in Exodus. We're going to get that in Deuteronomy 28 in great detail. And as we get to the end of Leviticus, it happens again. Once again, God, through Moses, lays out the blessings of obedience, the curses or the punishment for disobedience. And then he also, the thing he does all the time, there's a word I know that's what I'm looking for, I can't figure out what it is. As his pattern, thank you, who said that? As is his pattern, he promises the eternal or the long-lasting, everlasting covenant with this people, that he's not going to throw them off forever. He's always going to have this covenant with this people because, again, the covenant was not made on the basis of any kind of obedience or disobedience. The covenant of people was made with Abraham, and that was based on God's unilateral decision, and that's not going to go away. But there are going to be blessings and punishments based on the keeping of this law. So that's what chapter 26 really is all about. So as we get into it, we'll just read the first 13 verses. And just as we're reading the first 13 verses, just listen to the blessings that are promised for those who do the things that he calls them to do. He says in chapter 26, verse 1, "You shall not make idols for yourselves or erect an image or a pillar, and you shall not set up a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season. The land shall yield its increase, and the trees shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last to the time of the grape harvest, and the grape harvest shall last to the time for sowing. And you shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land securely. I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. I will remove harmful beasts from the land, and the sword shall not go through your land. You shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall chase 10,000. and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. I will turn to you and make you fruitful and will multiply you and will confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat old store kept long kept, and you shall clear out the old to make way for the new. I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves. And I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. So that is the promise of blessing. And it's conditioned upon obedience. That promise of blessing is clearly conditioned on obedience. If you do these things, if you keep my law, if you do not set up, make idols, if you do not bow down to false gods, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them. Those are all active things that the people of Israel were now required to do. They couldn't just be something or profess something. There was a call to action, if you will, and the call to action was, you shall do, you'll walk in the commandments, you'll observe the things I say, you'll not make any other gods, you'll not bow down to any other gods. Those are the four conditions, if you will, of this blessing. The four conditions for this blessing are: don't make idols, don't bow down to any other idol, those are the two negatives. Then there's two positives: walk in the commandments, walk in the law, and observe the law. Those are the four conditions for this obedience in this section. When we get to Deuteronomy 28, in several years, when we get to Deuteronomy 28. There's the blessings and the cursings, and again, it's those blessings are conditioned upon obedience. There's an if there, and the if is not a since. The if is, if you do this, I will then bless you. So this is a conditioned blessing, but once the conditions are met, it is a full blessing. I mean, there's not one thing missing from this blessing. There's not one area where they would be lacking if they would do what God called them to. There would be no famine in the land. In fact, he goes beyond just saying no famine until he's gonna bless their produce so much. I love the language that he uses. He says, You will eat old, how does he say that? You'll eat old store long kept. What does that mean? That your food's gonna get really old, you're gonna have to eat really old food? There's two things there, and Art got it right. It doesn't spoil. The old stuff is going to stay, but there's going to be so much of it, it's never going to run out. In fact, he says you're going to have to actually throw out the old stuff to make room for the new stuff. He also describes it as your harvest will last you until the grape harvest comes, and the grapes will last until the next, so there's never going to be a time. Even in the natural ebb and flow of harvests, not harvests, those kinds, there's never going to be a time when there's not provision made, where there's not food made, when there's not something in the storehouse for them to eat. There's never going to be a time of lack or of want or of need. God is going to provide for them that way, in that sense. And we know that as they get to the land in Numbers chapter 13, when they get to the land and they go out and spy it out, the land itself probably could have supported something like that. It was a land supposedly flowing with milk and honey. It was a land that it's described by the spies as a cluster of grapes so big, so large, not the grapes themselves, but the cluster so large that two men had to carry the cluster suspended on a pole. To carry a cluster of grapes. That's how bountiful this land was. Imagine then, that's how bountiful the land was when the Canaanites were in it. Imagine now that very land being blessed by God because the Israelites are in it, actually obeying him. That's a picture of immense blessing. And so if you read through that again, and sometimes it's fun just to read through and see how God would bless him. Yeah, Larry. No. Here's why. If you read through the Kings, if you read through that, there's typically there's one time in Israel when there is this there seems to be, on the part of the king, obedience this way. And that's the time of David. That's the only time that you read that. If you read the others, typically you'll read, he did as his father David did, yet he did not tear down the high places, but he did not, you know, there are things he didn't do. In most cases, in fact, I think as I've read those, all but maybe three, when it said he walked in the way of his father David, only three of them did it say, and he tore down high places, and he did that. Even the really good guys, like Uzziah, most of his life, Uzziah was a really good king. But at the end of his life, Uzziah usurped his place, and Uzziah went into the holy place and offered sacrifice that he shouldn't have done, and God struck him with leprosy. And he died leprous. He died, you know, in some sense an outcast, because if you're a leper, you couldn't be part of the community. You couldn't be part of the congregation, if you will. So historically, I don't think there's ever a record of this kind of blessing. There will be. There will be this kind of blessing. I believe in the millennial kingdom, that's exactly what's going to be going on, is the people of Israel will be blessed this way for the first time in their history. They will be. But if you track them getting into the land, remember, this is as they approach the land, they're getting ready to go in. If you track them going in the land, when we get into Joshua, which I don't see us ever doing that, but when we get into Joshua, if you're reading on your own, you'll find out that they go in and then they take the cities, but there's failure on their part almost immediately in the land. There's failure because they don't utterly drive out everybody from the land. Every tribe fails in the utterly driving out people from the land. So there's almost immediate failure. I got you in a second, Chris. And as there's almost immediate failure, then you get just one generation in, and they've forgotten God, and they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And so the cycle of judges is exactly what is described in chapter 26, verses 14 and following. It is this judgment that comes. And so Israel, because of her lack of obedience, because of her incomplete, and because of her failure to obey the way God told her to obey, never experienced this blessing at this point. I don't think they've ever experienced this kind of blessing. Now, there are clearly Israel is a blessed nation and experiences some of the blessing of it, but as described here, I don't think there's any record of history where they've actually experienced this. Because there's no record of history where they've actually obeyed the way God called them to obey. There's never been a time in history where they've done that. So long answer to short question. Short answer is no. I don't think we see it at all. Chris?
It seems like there's one time that maybe you got some of it. You know, maybe not all the protists and stuff, but definitely the peace. And the beginning of Saul was reigned by the protists.
Yeah, so Chris's thing is that if you look at the beginning of Solomon's reign, it sort of seems like that there's some of this peace and prosperity was there. Some of it was, but then what did Solomon do? Solomon took on, you know, what, 300, nine, how many, 700, 300, lots of wives, lots of concubines, and built high places for them, built pillars. And what does it exactly say? Yeah, the very beginning. What does it exactly say that you're not supposed to do? You'll not make idols for yourselves or erect an image or a pillar. What did Solomon do for his wives? He built pillars, a clear violation of this law. Well, Solomon didn't go himself to worship at those pillars. He allowed those pillars to be built. That is a sad statement. Now, could Israel believe God? Maybe the issue is, let's give them some slack. Okay, let's cut Israel just a little bit of slack, because they're people after all. And had they really seen God ever provide for them in that kind of miraculous way? Yeah, they saw it every morning. Right? They saw it every day. They saw God miraculously provide for them in a way that was unlike any other provision had ever been made. So what I like about this is God isn't saying, I want ignorant, blind, stupid obedience or uninformed hope. That's not what he's calling them to. He's calling them to obedience based on his faithfulness demonstrated in the past to them. He has walked with them over and over and over. And every time they've had an issue, he has provided for that issue, not just barely, but he's provided for that issue abundantly. You might say, well, okay, we'll get that, but let's go back to last week when we're talking about the Sabbath year. How could this people have ever trusted God that for a year they wouldn't do anything, yet God would provide for them for that year? He'd been setting that up for them every seventh day to this point. Every seventh day, they were getting an extra day's worth of manna. And there was a miraculous thing about that. Remember, on Monday through Friday, when you went out, or Sunday through Thursday, when you went out, you gathered one day's worth of manna. And you were to eat that one day's worth of manna. And if you woke up the next day, if you put your manna in a pot, thinking you'd hold some of that over for the next day, when you got up in the morning and looked in your pot, it was worm. There were worms in it. It was bad. It was rotten. On Friday, however, when you went to gather your manna, you gathered twice as much manna. And on Saturday morning, when you got up and looked into the pot, guess what was there? Half the manna not eaten with worms. So God had been giving them this demonstration every week that, yeah, I can provide for that extra day. I can provide for that year of rest. I'll take care of that. I can take care of you that way. So they had seen God do this kind of stuff. They had seen God provide for them. We'll talk about that in a second. Once in the land, never. As far as I know, and I've read lots of books on the period of the judges and Israel's history, and I don't ever know of any time when they were blessed this way. But they're going to be. I'm fully convinced they're going to be. There's the promise of prosperity with regard to food, and again. Just so we get it, food was not just a thing you got at the grocery store in those days. Food was a measure of wealth. What you had with regard to land, what you had with regard to produce, is a measure of wealth. There wasn't a lot of coin, trading going on like that. It was the way you had wealth was the kind of food and the kind of provisions you had. So what God is saying is, I will make you prosperous in the land. You will prosper with wealth. So there would be this prosperity. But again, but beyond prosperity, there's also a promise of peace. A promise of peace. The promise of peace is this. It's actually a threefold promise of peace. The first promise is that he's going to even remove vicious beasts from the land. That it's going to be there's going to be so much prosperity there that when they're not going to have to worry about lions tearing them up. They're not going to worry about those kinds of things because God is going to even remove the vicious beasts from the land. He says, "I'll remove harmful beasts from the land." So I think that's a twofold promise. There's a twofold promise. There are beasts that harm us people. Like lions and tigers and bears, oh my, right? There's beasts that harm people, but there are also beasts that harm crops, right? There are things that harm crops, like locusts, plagues, etc. One of the interesting things I find as you read through the minor prophets and read through the prophets is you'll find that God, on two occasions, sent locust plagues into the land. And the locusts came and they devoured the land. I think Amos refers to one of those, and I think Joel refers to a locust plague. I don't think those are just symbolic locust plagues. I think they are actual locust plagues that symbolize the future coming of the Chaldeans or the Assyrians. But God says, if you do these things, if you worship me and me alone, if you observe my commandments and you walk in them, then I'll remove harmful beasts from the land. There won't be there. So there's that promise of peace. But there's also a promise of peace regarding the enemy. There's a threefold promise. The second is there'll be no sword going throughout the land. What does that mean? What is no sword going? I think it's an indication that there'll be no fear of being harmed by anybody in the land. For instance, you wouldn't have to worry about your brother killing you. We don't have to worry about that. Why? Well, because if Israel's observing the law, what's one thing they're doing? They're loving the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind, and they're loving their neighbor as themselves, right? It's hard to love a neighbor as yourself as you're running him through with a sword. That doesn't indicate really love as yourself. And so if they're going to observe the commandments and walk in those commandments, they're going to be valuing life the way life ought to be valued. They're not going to be killing each other. So there's that fear gone because, and that's just gone because of how the law works itself out. Because of the prohibitions against murder in the law, that's how that works itself out. But beyond that, there's also the idea of the enemies coming through the land. They're not going to make it. I love the picture of what he says here. He says, your enemies, you will chase your enemies out. Five of you will chase 20 and 100 will chase 10,000. Now, doing the math, you know, if you're strictly doing the math, it doesn't seem to add up. Because 5 is not to 20 as 10 is to, or as 100 is to 10,000. You know, it's not an accurate ratio. So don't think of it strictly in math terms and think, okay, here's an error in the Bible because the ratio doesn't match up. Think of it hyperbolically. Okay, he's speaking in hyperbole, saying it's going to be like you're not even going to have to work to have the people go. It's not going to be an effort to make people not to chase people away. In other words, he's going to give them great victories in their driving out of people from the land. And you know what? The neat thing is that immediately in the land, he kind of demonstrates that for them. As later on, a generation later, as they go into the land, the first city they come up against is a place called Jericho, right? And boy, it was really hard for them to take Jericho, wasn't it? I mean, to take Jericho, you think about this, the effort they put in. They walked around Jericho once a day for 6 days, and on the seventh day they walked around it, or 6 days, on the sixth day they walked around it 7 times. And then they shouted, oh man, that was tough. That was tough. Then some folks blew trumpets and they shouted and the walls fell and they had this amazing victory. That was hard. No, see, God demonstrates that he can do this. He demonstrates for them in visual, living color, I can do this. So he sets them up for obedience. I think the whole wilderness wandering is a setup for obedience, and yet still they fail to do so. So the idea is this, that there's no reason, that was close. There's no reason to fear. There's no reason to be afraid because God will be going before them in the land, and God will protect them from enemies from within, and I think enemies from without. So there's this promise of peace. Peace with animals, peace with fellow Israelites, and peace with the nations around them. There will be great peace. So there's a promise of peace. There's a promise of prosperity. There's a promise of peace. And there's a promise of procreation. I had to come up with another P word, so I called it procreation. Reproductive prosperity, I guess you could call it. Let's just call it procreation. It sounds better. It's a good P word. And he says, I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply and confirm my covenant with you. So what is it when people are fruitful and multiply? That's procreation. In other words, their nation is going to grow. Their nation is going to prosper. I mean, consider how he prospered them in Egypt. Consider how God had prospered them in Egypt. He had prospered them even under great difficulty. Even under great duress and great persecution, God had prospered them. Imagine, if you will, now without that persecution, without that duress, without those issues coming, God saying, because you're obedient, because you're walking in my ways, because you're observing my law, because you're not worshiping any other God, now I'm going to prosper you. Well, I can't fathom that kind of prosperity and that kind of filling of the land with God's people. That's a promise. That's a promise he makes. And then I think that the last P is permanence. He promises with permanence. That's the old store kept long, clear out the old to make new. I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I like that. I will dwell with you, and by the way, I won't hate you either. that's really good news, isn't it? I love it. It doesn't say, and I will love you. I will love you with love, he says, but I'm going to make my dwelling place with you, and by the way, I won't hate you. Thank you, Lord. Thanks for not hating me. Why does he say that here? Why didn't he say, I will love you? He's already said, I love you. He's already told them that. In his selection of them as a nation, he's already demonstrated love for them. And what he's saying, I think, here is, I'm going to put you in the land permanently, and you're not going to have to fear my wrath. You're not going to fear my hatred. You're not going to have to fear me treating you that way, the way I treat those nations in the land right now that I do abhor. He absolutely did abhor the Canaanites. Going back to the curse of Ham, going back to Noah off the boat, and what happened back there in Genesis chapter 9 and 10. That he definitely abhorred the Canaanites. But he's saying, you get in the land, you follow me, you worship me, you do what I call you to, and I will not abhor you. You don't need to worry. You don't need to be concerned. You don't need to fear my wrath, because I'm going to be pouring out blessing so much that you can hardly stand it. So there's this promise of permanence, and it's permanence with him as their God, with in him in some sense him as their king, and they living as his subjects, but not like the subjects they were in the subjects of Pharaoh, as they were subjected under Pharaoh, where they were walking with bent over under this huge heavy load. No, they're going to be subjects of the Almighty, Most High, Yahweh, and they're going to be walking erect. They're going to be standing up and walking without having this burden, without having this pressure or these issues on them. They wouldn't be weighed down with care, with concern, because the bars have been broken. Look at the end of verse 13, I have broken the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. So this for them would have been, I think they would have understood this completely. Because this nation, this group, this generation that he's talking to is the very generation that just a year before had been slaves in Egypt. Just a year before, they had been under the taskmasters. They'd been under those taskmasters. They had been forced to do all this kind of labor. They'd been building cities for somebody else. They'd been doing all this stuff. They understood what it was to walk underneath the yoke of a burden. And so when this promise is made, we read it and think, oh yeah, okay, great. Because we don't live that way. When they read this, when they hear this, that matters to them. It matters to them because all they'd really known to this point, except for this year out of the land of Egypt, all they'd known all their life was walking and living under a burden, a yoke of slavery. And God says, I'm going to break that yoke. Not only am I going to, I have broken that yoke. You're no longer going to live that way. You're going to live as my subjects in my place. I will be your God. You'll be my people. And you will walk without the burden of slavery. That's the promise that he makes. That's the promise for obedience, or the blessings for obedience, if you will. Because I like to have things match, in my notes, it's the promise for obedience. Because the next section, you'd like to think, oh, yes, they're going to go in, life is going to be great, woohoo! But the next section are the punishments for disobedience. The punishments for disobedience. In every case, when God lays out the blessings for obedience, he always lays out the punishments for disobedience. In fact, in one place, he actually doesn't say if you disobey, but when you disobey, knowing the heart of man, knowing that they would disobey. So listen now to verses 14 through 32, I think it is. And listen, or 39, I guess, 14 to 39. But if you will not listen to me, if you will not do these commandments, if you spurn my statutes and your soul abhors my rules, so you will not do all my commandments and break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will visit you with panic, with wasting disease and fever that consume the eyes and make the heart ache. You shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues. And if in spite of this you will not listen to me, then I will discipline you again sevenfold for your sins. Let's stop for a second. So he says, first of all, if you don't do this, if you abhor me, if you spurn my commandments. And I think it's important to recognize that failure to obey is not just an accident. Failure to obey is not just, oops, sorry. God considers failure to obey as an active decision. The verbs used are active here. It's not just if you spurn my commandments, if you abhor my law. Those are active things. Those are things that you make a willful choice to do. You don't spurn something accidentally. Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Right. 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 So what Mike said is listen and do seem to be like outward, and that's absolutely true. Spurn and abhor seem to be inward motives and that's absolutely true. And that's why it's important to recognize, and I think that Deuteronomy, Moses does a really good job of this, is laying out that God never was calling them just to outwardly obey and to do. Never is there a call, do the law. Never is there a call for that. Every time you see God call the people to do the law, he first of all says, fear me, love me, keep my commandments, and do my law. You'll see that fourfold thing over and over and over again. At least you'll see the three, fear, love, do. Fear, love, do. But usually it's fear, love, keep, do. So what you see three heart attitudes that lead to the doing, right? You see fear, which is acknowledging God for who he is. Love, which is, giving and recognizing that because he's loved them, they were to love in response with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind. They were to keep his commandments. And keep does not mean do. Keep means to guard or to treasure or to value, to see them as important, to see them as valuable. And once you fear him, love him, keep the commandments, see them as valuable, then you do them. So there is a heart attitude that leads to that obedience, for sure. In the same sense, there's a heart attitude that leads to disobedience. And the heart attitude that leads to disobedience is the abhorrence of. Rather than valuing of the law, there's an abhorrence of the law, which is a hatred for the law. Rather than loving God and fearing God, there's a spurning of God. And so I think it's really important to recognize that disobedience doesn't just accidentally happen. Disobedience is a result of a willful choice in our minds to put ourselves first, or before we point the finger at ourselves, let's point the finger at Israel. Their disobedience was a decision on their part to put themselves before God and themselves before their neighbor. Rather than choosing to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind, and their neighbor as their self, they were choosing to love themselves with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind, and to love themselves as themselves, and to forget about their neighbor, and to use their neighbor. In fact, this week we read Micah, right? If you're reading through the Bible, hopefully you're still on track. If you've made it through to this point, you're over halfway done. Keep going. Keep going. But as we read through Micah, did you see how he talked about them grinding the bones of the poor, how they have just used up the poor? That should have never happened in Israel. Why did that happen? It happened because they were loving themselves and abhorring their neighbor. They were completely devaluing and disregarding the law of God. In fact, we read in Amos, they'd actually made the feasts all about them. They'd made the feasts all about, we love getting together and getting drunk. We love that. We love having this time together where we can just throw everything off and celebrate ourselves is what it, in fact, it had been that, because God says, I despise your feast days. Were they really Israel's feast days? No, they were God's feast days. But he doesn't say to them, I hate my feast days. I hate the way you celebrate my feasts. No, he says, I abhor your feasts. Because they'd hijacked them. They'd hijacked them. One push here, then I'll shut up for a second. But I wonder what God thinks about Christmas. I'm done. Yeah, Mike Gillespie.
God in flesh says, anyone loves me, he
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep. David.
So these are national promises with individual obligations.
Right.
It's unclear, though, how it's meted out to Israel. During the times of the kings, we see it appears to be related to how the king is following God. But during the times of the judges, what is it, the majority of the people?
Mm-hmm. That's excellent question. Dave's question is, you know, if you get into this is a blessing on a nation, not a blessing on individuals. Okay, and it's a curse on a nation, not a curse on individuals. Okay, it is a national curse, meted out on an individual basis. That's how it works. So the question is, it seems that, and if I get this wrong, Dave, tough. No, let me. It seems that. At least in the time of the kings, it's clear that as the king went, so went the blessing, cursing on the nation. In fact, that's why the northern nation Israel is taken away the way it is, because they never have a good king. They're all about worshiping idols. In fact, from Jeroboam I, he sets himself up as king and sets the nation up as idol worshippers immediately, saying, building these two golden calves and saying, Israel, here are your gods. He does that almost immediately, and every king of Israel, the northern nation, as you walk through what's said about them, is they typically follow in the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, lifting up, keeping the high places, not tearing them down, and there's no response to God whatsoever. So it seems like that kind of is the where the blessing and cursing comes from, is regard to what the king is doing. But what about the judges? What about the judges? Well, I think it's important as you read the judges to recognize and look what's happening tribally. Judges, as you get into judges, what you don't have is a solid, unified Israel. You don't have a federalized Israel, if you will, under one human king. You have 12 tribes who are at best a very loose confederacy. If you don't understand that, well, then you need to read some history a little bit of what federalism and confederacy is. Federalism is a strong central government that it's kind of what we're under right now. In fact, we are way too federalized. There's a political statement. We are way too federalized. States don't have the power they need to have. I'll just say that outright. As not intended by our founders, for sure. But that's what federalized is, a strong central government that yields some power to the states, some power to the little smaller rulers underneath them. Confederacy is every individual state, every individual tribe in this sense, has authority for itself and governs itself with its own government, kind of like we had in the early colonial period when we became a nation, where every state had its own kind of money. Every state printed its own cash, and there was commerce between each state on those kinds. That's what we have, only a very loose one as you get into judges. Every tribe had its own allotted space, and they were there. Their first priority was to drive everybody out, and as they successfully drove everybody out, then they would be ruled by God through the priests and Levites. That was how it was supposed to work. And so there was this very loose confederacy. And if you look at what happens in the judges, we don't have, so as you read judges, don't read, this is the history of all of Israel. No, it's the history of tribes of Israel as you're walking through. Because you walk through, and it'll say the tribe of Zebulun did not follow God, and so God raised up and took these people. If you read that, you'll see that it's usually a tribe or two tribes or some tribes that have been affected by this. And so I think rather than being on a national, it's on a tribal kind of basis. And when I say tribal, I'm not talking Aborigines. I'm talking about the tribes of Israel, okay? That's what they were referred to as, tribes, families, nations, clans, the tribes of Israel. So I think that the blessing and cursing is largely meted out that way, on the basis of what your tribe is doing. You'll see, we've already read Judges as we went through, but there's civil war during that time. It's during the time of Judges that the tribe of Dan, rather than being able to go take their land they're supposed to take and be down by Judah, where they're supposed to be, look at the allotment of land and look what Dan was supposed to have. Dan is supposed to have a chunk of land down southwest of Judah. That's where Dan is supposed to be. Where does Dan end up? Way up north by Galilee. How does that happen? How does Dan, who's supposed to be here, go up there? Well, Dan, we just couldn't drive them out. They're too strong for us. Oops, sorry. They were too strong for us. We can't do it. So because we can't take our land, let's go take our brother's land. In fact, you look at what Dan had and look at where they are in Galilee. It's a much better land up there. They went up and took some of their brother's land. They actually usurped their place. Never took what they were supposed to take. Never inhabited that land. Went up and took another nation, another tribe's land. Ephraim, however you want to say his name, they are a very nasty group of folk. They come against their brothers and try to take. They are land grabbing from almost the get-go. They're grabbing extra land. So you have, and it's interesting to me that I've mentioned this before, but the two tribes not listed in the book of Revelation, the 12 tribe list, there are two tribes not listed there, Ephraim and Dan, and they're both the land grabbing tribes. They're both that God said, here's your inheritance. They said, we don't want your inheritance. We want our own. We want our own. We want to add to or take somebody else's. And God says, okay, then guess what? I'm taking you out of the ledger then, if that's how you want to be. Again, that's a Revelation discussion. That's not necessarily a now discussion. So if you want to talk about that, later. Ron.
Two things. First, regarding Dan. Dan left Gaza and went to the Golan Heights.
Yeah, disputed.
But the thing that really applies here is that in the time of the judges, it wasn't entirely tribal, because you had at Shechem or Bethel, you had the tabernacle and you had the priests. Mm-hmm. So there was still some central, not necessarily government, but central influence.
Right.
Because there was relative peace after they did drive off a great portion of the Canaanites, there tended to be times when they just leave me alone, I'm going to do my farming, and
yep.
This is all I'm interested in, until the outside influences, the Philistines from Dan's area that he didn't control,
yep.
The Midianites from over on the other side of the river. It wasn't entirely...
Right. Yes, Ron's correct. He's saying it wasn't entirely a confederacy, because you did have the centralized tabernacle worship, and that's true. That's true. They did have centralized tabernacle worship, but as far as organized governance, you really don't have a strong central organized governance of the people. It was designed to be so. It was designed that God would be their God at wherever the place is. But remember, one generation in, they've forgotten God. So how effectively do you think his centralized reigning through his temple or tabernacle is going? Probably very poorly. Probably not really happening very well, because one generation in, they've forgotten God. We'll stop, because he makes an interesting statement. He's going to repeat it several times. I will discipline you again sevenfold for your sins. I want to talk about that next week, and then we'll spend some time talking about the vows and such. So, yes, Steve.
Could you tell us what your thoughts are on this
blessing and cursing of the tribes of Israel and how that relates to us now and grace.
Okay, Steve's question was, can I explain my thinking regarding the blessings and cursing of Israel and how that relates to us now under grace? I will do that, but I cannot possibly do that in 25 seconds or less. That is a good question, and that is someplace I intend to go. That's someplace I intend to go. Honestly, I thought we'd get through this whole chapter today. I don't know why I thought that, because I know me, but... And part of the summary of this chapter is exactly what you just brought up. So stick in with me, because I do want to talk about that, because that's an important principle how we apply this to our lives. So we'll talk about that next week. And if you're not here next week, we're recording all the Sunday school lessons, so you can listen online. I have no idea how you listen online. I don't know how that happens because I've never listened to them online. So find somebody who has and ask them. All right. So I'm not even going to ask you if you have questions because I don't have time to answer it. So I'm going to pray and then we'll let you go. Lord, thank you for this morning again. Lord, thank you for your word that is truth. Thank you for, again, revealing yourself to us so clearly. Lord, I ask that you would, this morning in the service that follows, you'd be glorified in our participation in communion and in those who are being baptized in their declaration of who you are and what you've done for them. And I pray you'd encourage us, give us the strength to be courageous for you this week. We ask this in your name, amen. Thanks, you're dismissed.